listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So onwards, if you're here tonight, you are no doubt already a fan of Armistead Maupin, whose Tales of the City concludes, or so the author tells us, but he has the right to renege, with a ninth volume, The Days of Anna Madrigal. But we are not here to mourn the ending of this marvelous series. We are here to celebrate this wonderful series. And obviously, many people feel the same way because the book will debut at number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list on February 9th, which is great. Congratulations, Armistead. Anna, the beloved transgender landlady of 28 Barbary Lane, is now 92 years old and committed to the notion of leaving like a lady. In this suspenseful and comic finale to Maupin's beloved series, we are treated to a convocation of the wonderful characters that he created over the years. In this volume, some members of Anna's family are bound for the otherworldly landscape of Burning Man, where, as Patrick Gale wrote in The Guardian, quote, "Who else but Maupin can write a scene in which a 67-year-old and his 40-year-old husband enjoy a three-way in an orgy tent with a much younger man wearing nothing but horns and goat legs and have the encounter seem ineffably wholesome and transformative?" I like that. It really is a rare skill. Anna herself has another Nevada destination in mind, a lonely stretch of road outside of Winnemucca, where the 16-year-old boy she used to be ran away from the whorehouse he then called home. More to be revealed soon. Armistead Maupin grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, graduated from university there, and served as a naval officer in the Mediterranean with the River Patrol Force in Vietnam. He worked as a reporter for a newspaper in Charleston, South Carolina, before being assigned to the San Francisco Bureau of the Associated Press in 1971. It was 1976 when he launched his groundbreaking Tales of the City serial in the San Francisco Chronicle, later moving to the San Francisco Examiner, where some of his better editors fought for him to use words never before seen in print in a daily newspaper. The serial went on to become a series of 8 internationally best-selling novels and a Peabody Award-winning miniseries starring Olympia Dukakis and Laura Linney. In his Tales of the City series, of which Days of Anna Madrigal is the 9th book, includes Tales of the City, More Tales of the City, Further Tales of the City, Baby Cake, Significant Others, Sure of You, Michael Tolliver Lives, and Marianne in Autumn. He is also the author of Maybe the Moon and the Night Listener. And in conversation with Armistead tonight, we are very thrilled to present Chris Freeman, who teaches at University of Southern California in the English and Gender Studies Department. Chris is also a board member of One, National Gay and Lesbian Archives, which is right here in Los Angeles. It's a phenomenal resource. How many of you know about One? Yes, we want to thank One for getting the word out tonight. And if you've never visited this archive, I really recommend it. We had a tour not too long ago, and it's just amazing. Chris's first book, The Isherwood Century, won a Lambda Literary Award, and he and his writing partner have recently completed a new collection of essays on Isherwood, the American Isherwood, which will be published in 2014, later in the year. They co-edited Love, West Hollywood, an anthology of tales of LGBTQ Los Angeles, and he is on the advisory board of the Monette Horwitz Trust and is working on editing the journals of the late Paul Monette for publication. Please join me in welcoming the great Armistead Maupin and Chris Freeman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, how nice to have such a delightful full house tonight for, poor me, I get to sit here and talk to Armistead Maupin for an hour. I've known Armistead for 15 years. He unfortunately turned us down when we asked him to write an essay for my first book, The Isherwood Century, and then the University of Wisconsin Press sent him The Galleys. And then he called me and he said, I need to write something.
Yeah.
I could not be that? A part of that.
Yeah.
I mean, not be not a part of that.
So he said, I need to write something. What can I do? And I said, write a foreword. So about 2 days later, I got a 7 or 8 page fax from you, and we changed, I think, 2 commas, and that was it. And we've been friends ever since, and it's such a pleasure to be here, and welcome to L.A.
Thanks, Chris. Good to see you.
Tonight, we're going to talk about a few interesting things. I've got my little scribbled notes here, and then we'll open it up so that you can have some opportunity to talk with Armistead, and then afterwards, he'll be signing books for you. Let's start, though. In the introduction, Louise told you that I'm on the board of One National Gay and Lesbian Archives, and Armistead told me a story about one from a long ago memory when we were in the green room. So why don't you tell that story?
Well, it was the first time I ever saw the word homosexual in the Raleigh News and Observer. I was 14 years old. I already knew, about myself.
I know.
I think I knew at 6, actually, but never mind. Mm-hmm. But the sexual component had come in. I knew that I was feeling this thing. Actually, it's interesting. I had sex dreams, but they did scare me until there was kissing involved, because that was the dangerous element. You know, boys knew that they could mess around with each other, but if there was this romantic element,
the intimacy, yeah.
And so I was really, really terrified, and I looked for the word everywhere. It could leap out off of a page at me, and there it was in the paper, because One was the original name of a magazine. It was I think they called it One, the homosexual magazine,
and
the AP.
The homosexual viewpoint.
The homosexual viewpoint. It wasn't, it didn't contain porn or beefcake or anything else. It was an early kind of activist magazine.
Absolutely.
That was talking about the fact that these people existed, and there had been a federal trial. I guess it was seized crossing
postmaster.
A state.
Yeah.
The postmaster seized it as obscene material, and that was scary to me. But there it was. Yeah. I mean, it was present, and I never forgot the name of the magazine or anything. It's just been with me all along. And I remember when the Institute, when I first started hearing about it here, I thought that fight had to occur.
Well, and it's astonishing to think it's been here for more than 60 years. You know, we think about the gay rights movement and Stonewall and all those things.
Yeah.
This is 25 years, you know, before that.
Yeah.
So it's
The Mattachine Society was meeting in somebody's house, I guess Harry Hayes' house.
With the curtains closed, and nobody knew each other's last names and all of that. I always remind my students about that world, you know, lest we forget.
Yeah.
I have a similar memory of when I was 12 years old, Anita Bryant was the enemy.
Mm.
And I had a very, very vivid memory of a newspaper story, you know, singer, spokesperson, you know, whatever, for this homosexual campaign. And I found it in my hometown newspaper, and I was off by one column of where I had remembered it. And this was when I was writing my dissertation. I put a footnote in there about that. And I felt
just
attacked.
Just indelibly.
I felt attacked by the, you know, I can remember being 12 years old, sitting on the floor in the living room reading the newspaper and feeling attacked, personally.
Yeah.
Right.
At 12.
At 12.
I felt it at 32 or whatever it was.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was reading it in the newspaper I was writing Tales of the City in, and I had to address it.
Right.
And I remember the editors of the paper saying, what does anybody in San Francisco care about what happens in South Florida?
Oh.
They didn't want me to do it. And I created a scene where Michael's mother writes him from Florida to say that she's joined...
Save Our Children.
The Save Our Children campaign. So he gets to say, I don't need saving. Thank you, Mama.
Right.
But by the strangest stroke of luck, I had already established Michael Tolliver as the son of Florida orange growers.
Isn't that hilarious? Yeah.
So it was just ripe for the picking,
yes,
as
indeed.
It were.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, and of course, and then conveniently, 5 minutes later, Prop 6 happens. Right, the Briggs Amendment, here in California, which is just straight, you know, a straight line from Florida to California.
Yep.
So, you know, it's this. So this gets me to my first thing I want to talk to you about. In the first, you guys know these wonderful television adaptations of Tales of the City. And in the first one, there's a cameo of you, Hitchcock-esque, younger and slimmer, but still.
Yeah.
looking up from your typewriter. And this reminds me of two things. One is one of my favorite Saturday Night Live skits where they're making fun of Tracy Chapman, who's trying to write songs, you know, you drive a fast car,
uh-huh.
I've got a ticket to anywhere, where Tracy Chapman has got writer's block, so she's looking out the window for material. And she starts trying to write a song for everything she sees.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the other thing is the opening of Berlin Stories, where Christopher talks about being in his room and writing about the world outside.
Yeah.
And, you know, Isherwood's fiction we talk about as documentary fiction. And you obviously are in that Isherwood tradition. So I wanted to open tonight, really, since we're in L.A., talking a little bit about Isherwood and your relationship to him, but also thinking about that kind of writing, the writing of the moment. You know, you're risking feeling dated or whatever, right, because you're writing about something that's today. But there's also something very important about that. So talk to us a little bit.
Well, if you do it for 40 years, you've got an epic on your hands.
Yeah, you do. You've written contemporary history.
I met Chris Isherwood and Don Bacardi, who's I'm going to be in conversation with Don tomorrow at the Santa Monica Library. We're still very dear friends. I met them at a party in L.A. on Oscar night in 1978. And it was kind of a protest party because the Bee Gees songs were ineligible for the Oscars because they had previously existed.
For Saturday Night Fever.
I think it was Kevin McCormick was the producer of Saturday Night Fever. And I was at this party. And I looked across the room and I saw Chris. I recognized him because he'd been in a PBS interview with these piercing blue eyes.
And the eyebrows.
Yeah. And I just fell in love with him. And I had read the books, of course, beforehand. Down there on a visit specifically, I think, was the one that really got me. But there he was with Don. And they were both in their cups.
yes.
And I told Chris that I wrote this this thing that was in the Chronicle, and he said, "Oh, that marvelous funny thing," or something. And of course,
yes.
So I had a drink and said, "Would you mind writing a review for the L.A. Times?" You don't do that,
no.
You know.
No. Well, you do.
Well, you do, but you. Yeah, I mean, you know. But he was very. He taught me a couple of things out of that I've since emulated. He didn't do reviews because he didn't want to say bad things about other writers. He knew how hard it was to do, and he didn't want to dishonor the effort. Mm-hmm. But he would write blurbs.
Right.
And he wrote me a blurb, and that I've used forever. And then when you this year you sent me a note saying that. His reading of Tales of the City was recorded in the latest publication of his diaries.
In the 70s diaries, yeah.
So, you know, I did what people do. I bought the book and went straight to the index.
Of course. Yeah, and you found yourself.
I found myself.
Yeah.
And he was saying sweet things about it. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really got me was when he said, I can't help thinking how much Whiston would have loved it, meaning Whiston Auden, the great poet of the 20th century. Totally thrilling.
Well, and it feels great to be part of that genealogy, you know. And of course, in Christopher and His Kind, Christopher tells the story of the first time Forster praised him. He said, who needs a Nobel Prize? I've been praised by Forster.
I think of it as gay genealogy.
Yeah, absolutely. That was my dissertation.
That we link ourselves that way, and especially when it's a sort of samizdat that you're passing along that everybody wasn't writing about these things. So if you found out that somebody was gay, you could link it back. Speaking of looking for your name in the the index, have you ever heard about when Gore Vidal finished Palimpsest, I guess it was, had a copy sent to Norman Mailer. And when Mailer got it, he did what every writer does. And when he got to his name in the index, he found a little thing in the margin that said, "Hi, Norm."
Yeah. Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Knowing the two of them.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? So let's talk a little bit about history. When you were writing those original columns in the mid-1970s, there was another very interesting thing happening in San Francisco at the time, which is the Mariposa Film Group was making Word Is Out.
Yes.
And you guys may, of course, remember watching Word Is Out on PBS. It came out in 1977. And I use the phrase coming out. It came out, I use that advisedly, because this was big news. And so I kind of want you to talk a little bit about that milieu of being in San Francisco at a time when you could be poor and be there, which, of course, that no longer exists, but also at a time when this kind of national awareness of coming out was starting to really become a thing.
Well, we treasured every little thing. We knew what it was. We knew every, well, there weren't any actors that were coming out, but we knew everything, any movie that had the slightest nod.
That certain summer, 1972.
That certain summer with
Martin Sheen.
Martin Sheen and
Hal Holbrook.
Hal Holbrook. Yeah.
1972, ABC Movie of the Week.
Yeah.
Set in San Francisco.
Set in San Francisco.
He's an architect, of course.
Yeah. nobody missed that. Mm-hmm. But Word Is Out made stars out of the people who were in it. Mm-hmm. Tom Amiano, who's now a revered elder member of the California state legislature and a long history of activism. Mm-hmm. Pat Bond.
Yes.
A wonderful blonde.
Dyke. World War II Dyke.
Smoking. A giant, but, you know, I think she cried on camera.
Yeah.
She was just so real. And she, just speaking of what we were speaking of backstage, she had a woman. She put together a one-woman show after that and traveled, just talking to the audience. Oh. Yeah, I thought that film was brilliant and absolutely groundbreaking in a way that it's hard to describe now.
But I see parallels between what that film is doing. That's why I go back to this kind of theme of documentary, because what you were writing, you know, you were getting material. You were in lab every time you were, you know, outside, inside.
Sometimes wherever. Simultaneously, by the way.
Typing with one hand, and I don't know what you were doing with the other.
Well, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll save that a little later. I don't know.
You're among friends.
I would come in, when I was in San Francisco just on tour, one of the women that worked with me in the people department, which was the euphemism for the women's department.
Right. It
sounded kind of primitive with feminism on the rise to call it the women's department, as if there was something different that women wanted to read.
You're right.
But they remembered me coming in late and telling them stories and just going on and not sitting down to write. And they needed 800 words a day from me. And I was not turning it out. I kept them nervous, and I didn't mean to. And I was really happy to hear from her that they remembered me fondly and liked me. I don't think I told them about the time that I had a total mental block. One afternoon, I thought, I can't do this. And I left the building, walked two blocks to a sex club, had a good time, came back. For some reason, the very crusty old editor of the Chronicle, Charles Tyriot, called me into his office to discuss something. And I was sitting there like this, talking to him, and I looked down, and there was an enormous wad of pink bubble gum on my knee.
I don't know how it could have gotten there. I have no idea how that could have gotten there.
And I was amused by that at the time. Actually, I still am amused by it. Just because of the youthful foible thing, but anything that happened to me at night, regardless of things that happened to me, got plowed into the story. I met a really attractive guy at the Twin Peaks in the Castro one night, and he invited me home. And it wasn't until I got there that I realized he was attracted to my shoes. I had Weejuns, the preppy old Weejuns, and he was a Weejuns fetishist. Oh. He had pictures of Weejuns framed, hanging on the walls.
Nice.
It was kind of crushing, actually. Thinking, oh, yeah, well.
Yeah.
There they are. He had an ad in The Advocate, which was how people found each other in those days. It said, Bass Weejuns. I found out later that he was the night clerk at the Huntington Hotel, which at the time was the last place in town that would shine your shoes if you left them outside the door at night.
It's the perfect job for him.
He cruised the halls.
Yeah.
looking for Ouijans.
Right.
So there it was. I had a chapter. And I could write that and, you know that I'd done my job for the day and then move on to something else. And whatever, yeah, somebody else. And I took my randiness and gave it to the straight guy.
Right.
And wrote about him and imagined what his life would be like. And so I used everything I could possibly get my hands on.
And it was all in service of the craft.
Oh, I didn't mean that.
Oh. So I want to, one of my students is working on a project on you for a class I'm doing right now. And I kind of, you know, there's a lot of talk on your book tour right now about the end, the end, the end. But what I want us to think about for a minute is how great would it be to read Tales of the City for the first time right now for a 20-year-old? You know,
it'd certainly be great for me. I'd appreciate that very much.
Yeah. But, you know, there's something about that, the idea of kind of the first time. Because people tend to, I mean, when they discover your books, at whatever time they discovered them, if a few of them had already been published, they would binge. I was writing my Isherwood chapter, and I came across you. Well, my best friend in graduate school was a huge fan, and I came across you in some of my Isherwood research. So I just thought, oh, I need a break from all my research. So I started reading, and then I didn't write anything for a month because all I did was read your books. And I remember just the pleasure and the kind of vicarious, the way you take us there, right? And so for somebody, this world is very different in 2014 than it was in 1977, you know, in terms of how you go about business. So I think it must be so wonderful, you talked about 40-year legacy, to go back, to imagine, you know, what would you want to say to a young reader who's picking up and reading page one?
Well, I just hope it works on a heart level, basically, because nothing lasts if it doesn't. If you can't feel, if you can't be inside that character, all the rest is just trappings, you know. Mm-hmm. But it is weird to think that they read it the way I read P.G. Woodhouse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
as revelatory about a particular time, as quaint,
and as sweet, as something that they long for.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I hear from 20-year-olds who are binging on it now, which is I really like. It's funny to think that there are people that now will be able to sit down and read all 9 in a row.
Mm-hmm. They read the Harry Potter books and then they read the Armistead Maugham books.
Yeah, it's.
I mean, it's an interesting. I wish I could have had that childhood.
Of reading those?
Yeah.
You know, I hear from people that grown-ups who said, "I read you when I was 12 years old, when it was in the Chronicle."
Right.
And I would wait until my parents were through with a paper, and then take it somewhere they couldn't see me reading it, and read it. And of course, there's nothing in it graphic. It was in a daily newspaper.
Right.
The first
PG.
Scenes just between Michael and John, I couldn't say they were in bed together, but I could say something like, John adjusted the sheet, or, you know, something that you could, built, it lets you know that's where they were.
But that discretion leaves so much for the reader to imagine.
Yeah, I think it was good for me. A whole
As
lot
a writer,
of the restrictions that were put on me were very good for me. I might have come charging out and used all the material at once. They wouldn't let me at the Chronicle. They wouldn't let me discuss Anna Madrigal's transgender nature for the first year. They thought people were going to run screaming into the woods. It was amazing.
But she came to you as a trans character?
She did.
Because at that point, we had Christine Jorgensen, and I don't even think we had Renee Richards yet.
We didn't have Renee Richards.
Yeah.
Christine Jorgensen, of course, was, I don't think
world
I even
famous.
Heard about her the first time when she was famous. The two for me were Dawn Langley Hall in Charleston, who had been Gordon Langley Hall, who was an Englishman, who was the foster son, adopted son, of Dame Margaret Rutherford, Miss Marple.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the toast of Charleston. He wrote books about famous women. He was, you know, kind of charming Englishman who bought an old house in the nice neighborhood.
Right.
And then he went to Johns Hopkins and undergo sexual reassignment and was beginning to cross-dress. He met and fell in love with an African-American shrimp boat fisherman.
Well.
All of which was, you know, observed by the neighbors.
Carefully, I meant.
Froze him out in a big way. I remember when the story broke that Time or somebody went to Margaret Rutherford and said, what do you think about the fact that your son is now identifying as a woman and is in a interracial
marriage. Boyfriend. Yeah.
And has this black boyfriend. And she said, I do wish Gordon hadn't picked a Baptist. Nobody can say fuck you like an old English lady. You know?
Right, right. As we see from Maggie Smith every week on Downton Abbey.
That's a Maggie Smith line.
Yes.
And she was treated very cruelly. Mm-hmm. And when she died, I don't know, it's 7 or 8 years ago, there was an obit in the New York Times. And it was all apologies. It was people saying we behaved so badly and we feel so bad about it. When I moved to San Francisco, so it was on my radar. I remember reading it. I was a naval officer, and I remember reading it, the story, on a printout off of the ship's message system, like an old telegraph thing. When I moved to San Francisco, one of the first stories I covered was a fundraiser at California Hall for a transgendered woman named Kate Marlowe, who had been Kenneth Marlowe, who was... the surgery is expensive, and she was trying to raise money for her surgery, and she named it The Ball to End All Balls.
Well, there you go.
You know, people who are brave and witty at the same time, you know.
Yes.
And she had a... The dance was... she got the Benny Goodman Orchestra in there, or what was left of it, in 1970. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of all these old people, age now, ballroom dancing to the Benny Goodman Orchestra. And the halftime entertainment was Sally Rand, the fan dancer.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. She was still doing it at 70.
She needed more fans.
She just needed a 3-watt blue bulb.
Yes.
And she did it. I went out and celebrated Sally's 70th birthday with her and Kate Marlowe. And at that time, Kate told me that she was raised in a brothel in Winnemucca, Nevada.
Well, there you go.
Turned out not to be true at all. She was a bit of a fabulist.
Yes.
At least she didn't say that in her self-published autobiography.
Okay.
She said her parents were gangsters in Detroit or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it stayed in my head, and I just was fascinated by the notion of what it would be for a little boy who feels like a little girl to be surrounded by women in that environment.
Yeah.
And that finally plays out in this book.
Yes. And, you know, it's interesting because, again, the issue now is very much transgender rights and, you know, from all the way, I teach a course about transgender issues, and, you know, these kids are very, very young when they're starting to recognize something that we also recognized in ourselves in a different way, perhaps.
Yeah.
But this issue of sort of self-determination is something that's very controversial, and it's the issue of our time. And here you are again writing about it.
Last night in Portland, I had a woman waiting in line saying, my child, who was born a girl, told me at 4 that she's a boy, and we're working on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is the issue of our time.
It is. And it's the last issue, but precisely because it requires us to look at other people as human beings, to find that core that isn't male or female, or gay or straight or whatever. To who is this person?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I always loved it as a topic. That's why it challenges me when I introduced a trans man.
Jake
Greenleaf, 8 years ago, it grew out of a story that a friend of mine told me about being down at the Lone Star, the gay bear bar in San Francisco, and seeing a cute cub there. and halfway through, you know, flirting at the bar, goes to the bathroom, and somebody else there says, you don't want to go that home.
Yeah.
And my friend is a good man, and by that time he was kind of turned on anyway. And he thought, this is a challenge for me, and whatever we have to negotiate when we go home, that's what we'll do. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I want to write about that person. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a gay trans man,
right?
So
yeah,
he's got the special challenge mm-hmm. of hanging out in places, picking up men when he's not got the one thing that a lot of men are looking for.
Yes, I'm not following you, but anyway,
you're not. You teach transgender studies.
Oh yes. Oh, maybe I am. Maybe I am.
But obviously not all men, by the way.
Correct.
I'm wrong in that assumption.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, this fascinates me. Well, and I think there's such bravery.
Yeah, and in my class, we actually sort of this first conversation and the last conversation focus on what it is to have a livable life. You know, what are you willing to do to have a livable life?
Yeah.
What will that take? I want to segue now into the sort of end of the first series. I want you to talk about Rock Hudson a little bit, because since we're in L.A. again, I want to hear a few more L.A. stories, because you became close, very close, with Rock Hudson at a certain point. And also, I want to talk then about how AIDS came into the Tales story, because that you were the first person to really write fiction that included AIDS. Mm. And this is in the very early 1980s. And that history, of course, is now 30 years old and is extremely important. So, you know, you're writing this comedy, and then all of a sudden this tragedy is happening.
Yeah, I had to deal with it.
Yeah, so let's talk about that.
Well, I lost a friend in 1982 who was like a little brother in what I call my logical family. Mm-hmm. And he'd moved back east to work in New York, and suddenly he was ill. And I remember one of us coming into the house. We lived in this sort of... big apartment with a bunch of people coming and going. Dave Coppé, the openly gay
NFL
football player, was there at one point, and Randy Schiltz. It was like a gay fraternity house. It was really a trip. And somebody came in one day and said, "This is what Daniel's got," and it was the cover of a New York magazine. Mm-hmm. I think it was. It said, "The Gay Plague." Mm-hmm. You know, I can still remember the horror of that. Of that moment, mm-hmm. really, and he was gone really quickly.
Oh, yeah, it was 3 to 6 months in those days.
So when Rock came along, I had met Rock a few months before Tales of the City started in the Chronicle.
Okay.
And we met because of somebody, it was a gay way that we met. A guy that I met at a bar in San Francisco said, "Let's go to Palm Springs. There's going to be a gallery opening." And Rock Hudson, I remember the name of the other guy. It's so funny because the people who were saying come to the gallery were Rock Hudson and Prince Umberto de Poliolo.
Oh, well, you have to say yes to that invitation.
Well,
yeah, or C.
You know what a prince in Palm Springs is.
Yes.
An old queen.
Yes. I do know, yes.
Yeah. And... I think he was the Ava Gabor variety of royalty.
Zsa-Zsa's prince goes to my gym.
Yeah, you know the prince.
Oh, I know all about the prince.
Yeah.
Yes. Prince Frederick.
Prince Frederick von Anhalt, or
yes,
whatever his name
is. With his Speedo and his Rolex.
Two very important things when you're a prince.
You may have to leave the stage for a minute.
Well, so I went to the, this is way too long a story. I didn't meet Rock in Palm Springs, but I met a bunch of his friends. And then they said, "We're going to San Bernardino because he's going to be in John Brown's Body," because he really wanted to do stage at that point.
He really wanted to if he's doing it in San Bernardino.
He really wanted to. He did. And we all went backstage to meet him after, and I was sort of nervously waiting to meet him in line. You know, with the friends, they're all sort of filing through this very small dressing room. And suddenly there's a power failure. And his hand is in mine and it's pitch dark. And I said nervously, "I've waited for this opportunity all my life." Subsequently, he came through San Francisco.
I think you just yada, yada, yada us.
No, nothing happened.
Oh, okay.
Nothing happened.
Okay.
He came through San Francisco and he invited us up to his suite at the Fairmont Hotel, the Diplomat Suite at the Fairmont Hotel. And it was the night before Tales appeared in the Chronicle. And I had already bragged to him that I had written this thing that was going to be in the newspaper tomorrow morning. And he went to the desk at the Fairmont and got what they call the Bulldog Edition. In those days, they had an early edition of the newspaper you could get the night before. And when we got up to the room, he said, I have a little dramatic reading I'd like to do.
Oh, no.
And he read the first chapter of Tales of the City. Kind of drunkenly, not very well, but oh, my God. If he wanted to seduce me, and I guess he did, it worked.
Yeah.
The weird thing was that the thing actually has Marianne's mother on the phone saying, get out of that terrible city. Awful things happen there. Mm-hmm. Your father and I were just watching Macmillan in White.
Oh, no. Oh. I think you're psychic. I don't know.
I just had this complete multimedia experience with it.
Yeah. And you urged him to come out of the closet.
I did, actually. The next night.
Well, yes. Why waste time?
Yeah.
And he said?
His partner said, not until my mother dies.
Mm. Well, you know.
I thought if I were fucking Rock Hudson, I would be telling my mother in 10 seconds.
You know it. Yeah.
That would be that would solve the problem right there.
Yeah.
In fact, that was in a big way, that was what helped me so much, was the notion that this, this paragon of film masculinity was a gay man. And he wasn't different in real life. Mm-hmm. He wasn't Liberace.
Right.
He was Rock Hudson. Mm-hmm. And so it was a big deal in that way. But yes, and so he didn't want to. He talked about it. In fact, when he finally announced that he had AIDS and got a biographer.
Did you know before that?
I didn't. I had friends saying things about it. And I thought, oh, no, of course not. I mean, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. They kept the lid on really, really. The little family circle closed around him. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't seen him for several years.
Right. Because he died in 85, and you're talking about 1978, when you met him?
Yeah, I think the last time I saw him was the late 70s. And the reason might be interesting to you. I mean, I was becoming known as an openly gay person, and it didn't fit with me.
Right.
And I didn't like the fact that I was part of his subterranean life. Right. The friendship didn't seem viable to me anymore. There was no big rift, but it just didn't happen. So when the time came, and Randy Schiltz, by the way, was the person who called when he had AIDS and told me, and because Randy and I were friends, he thought another reporter should call me. But I talked about Rock being gay. I fundamentally outed him.
Right.
But I knew it's what I had to do. I knew somebody had to step in who had some dignity around the thing and say, of course he was gay. Everybody in Hollywood knew he was gay.
Right.
He's loved. This is don't make a scandal out of it.
Right.
And as a result, People Magazine wrote what I think is probably the first civilized explanation of a public gay life that was ever done. And he got 30,000 letters at the hospital telling him how much they loved him.
Wow.
And he sent, when Sarah Davids wrote the biography, she came to me and she said, Rock says you're the first person I should come to. So.
There you go. So he did come out just in his own way.
He did.
Yeah.
He had always talked about the book when I met him. He says, yeah, we're going to write the book.
Mm-hmm.
The book was where the truth was going to be put. That was going to, finally he wouldn't let himself do it, but he would tell the truth at last and free himself. Mm-hmm. He had a groove, looked like a deformity on his thumbnail, that was from doing that. Mm-hmm. I asked him, and he said it was a war wound, and I believed him. And then his personal assistant and also part of his extended family said, oh, is that a war wound? Don't you see what he does?
OCD, yeah.
He just gnawed away at himself all day long.
Wow.
And his alcoholism, I think,
was
related to that, too.
So in a minute, we're going to open up for questions, but I wanted to... A lot of the publicity around your tour has been about the end of the Tales series, but what I wanted to do is talk about the new beginning of it, which was Michael Tolliver Lives. Because so you wrote, you know, you wrote AIDS into it starting, I guess, was Baby Cakes, maybe 84. And Michael, of course, basically has to be HIV positive in the reality
of
that.
Yeah, I knew he had to be.
And so you stopped with Sure of You in 89 because you were going to have to kill him.
That's right. And I became cowardly about it. I couldn't do it. I mean,
well, I don't partially, think, I'm not sure cowardly is the right word.
Well, I mean,
you didn't want to kill him.
Largely, I was driven by the fact that I did not want to write this epic story and have the gay man die at the end.
Yes.
Because that had been the tradition
the
in the culture.
Right.
Gay or lesbian, if you're in a piece of public, you know, I think about that. Right. Was it a little movie called The Fox where the tree falls?
The Little Foxes. Yeah, the D.H. Lawrence story.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, and of course, that brings us to Celluloid Closet, which is the great thing that you did in that period where you weren't writing the tales. You wrote the screenplay.
I wrote the narration for Vito Russo, of course, it created this brilliant
But it's such
thesis.
An important film, and it tells all those stories, you know, and it came out at such an important time, still before the protease inhibitors.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, so tell us, maybe this will be the last anecdote I'll ask you to tell us. Tell us how finally Michael Tolliver Lives came to be.
We can trace it all back to Isherwood.
Let's do it.
I had this conceit that I was going to try to do my version of a single man, a day in the life of a middle-aged gay man, in this case, someone who's HIV positive, a smaller, delicate book that dealt with that, with my generation and the survivors. I'm not positive myself, but I've never felt... almost everyone I've ever loved has been. So I wanted to celebrate those people in some way.
The survivors.
In a small, delicate book. And then I realized that I had such a man in my repertoire.
Hello.
And that Michael wasn't dead. You know, I had the protease of the inhibitors have come along, and he's one of the ones that made it.
Yeah, and many people did.
Many did.
Make it.
And still do, and suffer from the consequences of the treatment, but are still around.
Yeah.
Palm Springs is full of them.
Yep.
I have a friend who's making a documentary on the guys that are, as I put it, facing mortality in the ordinary way.
Yeah. Well, you know, I work on Paul Monette. He's 1 year younger
than you. He just missed it.
Yeah. He died in February of 1995. If he had lived 6 months longer... He and I might be sitting here talking about his next new book.
I know. It breaks my heart.
And every time I meet a gay man 70 years old, I think, that's Paul. That could be Paul.
Yeah.
He died at 49, which is, I will be in 1 year.
I had a friend.
We have to take that out of the podcast.
Who? That's the part we won't talk about.
Yeah, we have to erase that.
Oh, come on. So I had this character. And so I just decided to write in first person. And in order not to disappoint the people that had been following the series, I made the point of saying this is not a continuation of Tales of the City. But of course it was. And I wish I hadn't done it because I was forever, you know, trying to correct that that statement. But some people didn't like it for that reason. They thought it was really that I'd suddenly gone autobiographical in some way because I was writing from the first person.
About somebody you made up?
The British were especially annoyed by it for some reason. I don't know why, but the reviewers...
That's also Isherwood overflow.
Is that it?
They never forgave him for leaving in 1939.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
I'm not sorry I did it. I like the fact that it becomes personal. I wanted to pay the attention to the gay character. So that was the reason.
Very good. So Tales of the City is not dead either. It lives.
I hope so. I feel that by sealing off the story and saying this is it, this is the entity, these are the 9 books. If you love these people, then go back and visit them again.
Right.
That's roughly the way I feel about it.
Yes, I think that's the way most of
us feel. If I have to keep writing, I'll feel like I'm in misery territory.
Well, on that note, let's have some questions from the audience. You guys all are very well aware of this man and his work, and so let's hear from a few of you.
Well, first of all, I was sitting here beforehand listening to Billie Holiday's I Remember? So that was great. But I want to go back to what you were talking about of the 20-somethings reading. Of course, I was struck with the analogy of the monarch and how Anna says the young always know where to go, or some, I'm tangling that all up. But and it reminded me of a choral work written by Roger Borland and John Hall called Flashpoint Stonewall. In there, there's a song called The Parade, and the whole gist of it are young people at a parade, a pride parade, standing on the shoulders of the ones that came before. Mm-hmm. Shoulders still damp with tears are some one of the lyrics. And so my wish for you is, and you have a lot of people who come up and tell you they're touched by it, of course, I'm sure. My wish for you is that hopefully you take it in and realize that you are our shoulders now and will be for many years to come.
And thank you. You know that this is like the fifth stop on a book tour, and I hear, I feel so blessed. I get the most personal stories. Every fifth person cries in my arms. Mm-hmm. If I see them start to blubber, I can't help it, and so we have to get up, and then we have a good laugh about it. But and the challenge is just to receive it, to take it in, feel it, and not have a moment of doubt about myself anymore in any way, because the love just feels extraordinary and wonderful.
Big spoiler alert. So,
yeah. By the way, on the Billie Holiday thing, that's a reference to something in the book here. That song plays a crucial place in the book. I posted it, a YouTube of it.
That's where I got it.
Mm-hmm. Is that where you saw it?
Yeah.
And somebody over there, spoiler alert, spoiler. I said, just a song.
Right. Yeah. But anyway.
But thank you. That's very kind.
Even
of you.
Anna accepts it, so I won't go into detail. Right. But, you know, climb on that monarch and accept it the way she did.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah.
That's very sweet.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I saw other hands. There must be questions, comments. Way back there.
Hi, Armistead.
Howdy.
So enough about you.
Yeah, really.
Are you aware of anyone, if you had been doing this now, starting out Tales Now, you'd be blogging it, probably. So
that is the modern equivalent to serializing in a newspaper.
Right. So are you aware of anyone blogging or not now, who is the 21st century you?
I have read a serial fiction online that is very thrilling. There's a woman I met on Twitter named Catherine Cook, who is the wife of the dean of Liverpool Cathedral.
Oh, my God.
She's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. We had this sort of teasy relationship on Twitter, and then she writes something called the Linchester Chronicles serially online that's just about life within a modern Anglican Episcopal close, you know, like life at the cathedral. Mm-hmm. But she's got, you know, she's got gay characters.
Well,
in
of course.
There. Yeah, how could you not?
Please.
But it's there, and who's gossiping about whom, and it's beautifully written. It's probably not the answer you're expecting to get, but it's a lot of fun. I really was laughing very hard. It's like an old-timey English village comedy with a very modern sensibility.
And, of course, Shauna.
And Shauna has been...
Right, writes her tweet novel.
Shauna, the 30-year-old in here has a... I actually thought that was a really good idea when I thought it up. I thought I'd probably never do it myself.
Right. But give it to her.
It's a sort of horror story about... that's all... all in text messages.
Texts, yeah.
And it's called Private Message. It's spelled PVTMSG.
Right.
And it's just girls, teenage girls, talking back and forth about another girl that they're being mean to, and it gets out of hand.
Which happens, I hear.
I think, well, now there's, what is that, Snapchat?
Yeah.
You heard about this?
Yeah.
You can tweet instantaneously and send photographs and messages that disappear in 20 seconds or something. So you can say something really cruel or show something really explicit, and your parents can't track it.
Mm-hmm. This message will self-destruct in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
We have plenty we could keep talking about, but...
These books are basically a chronicle of your love affair with San Francisco.
Where's this person?
He's
I'm right here.
Next to Sarah.
Should I stand?
Okay. Yeah, there you go.
All right. So these books are basically a chronicle of your love affair with San Francisco, and I'm wondering what other cities you cheated on San Francisco with during this time. What other cities do you love as much as San Francisco?
Well, some people think I've just had a divorce because I moved to Santa Fe, but not true at all. I'm totally in love. How could I not be in love with San Francisco? I lived for 3 years. Chris knows about it because he came to visit. Or later on when my sister owned it. I had a house in New Zealand, the very rural part of New Zealand for 3 years.
The end of the world, we could call it.
Totally the end of the world. There was nothing between the front porch and Antarctica. And it
He's not kidding.
It felt like it, too, sometimes. Yeah.
Off the coast of Christchurch.
Yeah. And what other places? I've loved a number of places in my lifetime here. I lived in Charleston, South Carolina for a while. It's a beautiful city. I loved it. I love the Gothic nature of what goes on there. I lived in Newport when I was a naval officer, and that was a wonderful experience.
Newport, Rhode Island, not Newport Beach.
Not Newport Beach.
No.
You
never lived in L.A. Were you ever tempted?
I had 3 months at the Chateau Marmont.
Well, aren't you fancy?
That's like that's like 10 years in L.A.
Yeah. And you're staying right across the street from there, basically.
I'm staying right across the street from there, and I'm having all sorts of flashbacks. Yeah. Thinking, oh, is that building still there?
And and I live 2 blocks down the hill from where you are. Yeah.
Yeah. It just gave me everything I needed. It was like a big dose of all the fantasies I'd ever had
when
about LA.
When was that? When was that?
1979.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And I got...
Well, I guess so. Was John Belushi there?
In those days, the rotary thing fell off the phone when you tried to dial it, you know.
Yeah.
And there was a guy that answered the phone there, the switchboard operator, who was straight out of a Gothic novel. He said, Chateau Maman.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would go eat tapioca at Green Blatt's. Mm-hmm. And in the morning, I had my eggs at the counter at Schwab's, for heaven's sake.
Yep.
And I'd buy the Hollywood Reporter in the morning, and I'd look for news of my forthcoming film that I was convinced was going to happen any minute now, because Warner Brothers had bought the rights to Tales of the City in 1979. And I didn't know that that doesn't mean anything necessarily.
Welcome to L.A.
Maybe the Moon, my Hollywood novel, I have the character say, Hollywood is a town where you can die of encouragement.
It's true. It's true. Now, can we, may I ask a question?
Please.
Let's talk a little bit about Paul Monette, because Paul lived up King's Road. You could see his house practically from where you're staying right now, and was going to Greenblatt's, and he moved here in 77, Thanksgiving of 77, to be in Hollywood. And he made a little money and sold a few things. Nothing really much got made. But did you know him in those days? Or what were your interactions with Paul?
Yeah, he actually drove me in that famous, the lemon yellow Mercedes convertible that he talks about.
That someone robbed at Book Soup? Is that the one that he got?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Somebody at gunpoint in the parking lot at Book Soup stole that car from him.
Was he at the bookstore or in the alley behind Book Soup?
I will have to let Paul answer that question.
Yeah. That alley was featured in Making Love, that movie. Remember that?
Yes.
My sweet memory of Paul in Hollywood was of him taking me, driving me to a different light at
when it was in Silver Lake.
In Silver Lake, in that car,
yeah,
to my reading. And there's a picture somewhere in my stuff of the two of us. Oh, yeah, I'll find it for you.
Please.
They're both of us, we're dragging on a joint before we go into the book
signing. And which book would that have? What, can you help me with the year?
It must have been Further Tales.
So early 80s?
Yeah, early 80s. Okay. I went there once with Paul, and I went there once with Tammy Dutrow, who was my friend that inspired Maybe the Moon, who was at one point the shortest woman in the world in the Guinness Book of World Records. And she kind of ran away to Hollywood when I was when I knew her in San Francisco, and she said, "I'm going to go work in the movies." And I thought, "Oh, God bless you, girl." But
it's not the pictures that got
it's
big.
It's going to be, yeah. And she called me up and said, "I'm in Steven Spielberg's next film." And she'd been hired to wear the suit of E.T.
There you go.
That was her dilemma in that situation, because she was supposed to be secretive about it. Struck me as really, there was a parallel running along there with gay actors or anybody that's supposed to look like
she was wearing a mask.
She was wearing a mask.
Yeah.
And she went and did a book signing with me at a different light and sat with me at the table, and people found out who she was, and she was signing E.T.'s. I love knowing that about you. Remember in E.T. when you see him with the wig on and it's supposed to
yes.
be funny because he's a girl, you know?
Right.
He's hiding in the closet. He is a girl. I would like
yes.
to...
Two more questions. Yes. Devin, give us somebody.
Hi. I was fortunate enough to have been doing some graduate work in San Francisco in 77 and then moved there for 3 years in 78. And I wondered... Have you noticed a difference in reception from people who have lived in the Bay Area or in San Francisco itself and how they appreciate your work compared to people who've only been there on vacation once or never even been there at all?
I don't know. The appreciation level seems to be the same, because I do have this wonderful thing to work with, you know. Yes, obviously, people who've lived there know the nuances of it more, but there's a lot of distant affection for it from all sorts of people, maybe who don't even know what it's like anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to. I mean, it, certainly, it's not as far as my books are concerned. The level of people, the tourism part of it. Some of them are the strongest fans of the books. There's something called Tours of the Tales happening. Mm-hmm.
San Francisco now. Owes you money, don't you think?
Yeah, I've been speaking to the Chamber of Commerce about that.
You need royalty checks or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to do it?
Last one.
Hi, Armistead. I wanted to tell you how much I love the books, but I also love the miniseries. They're just so fantastic. And I wanted to know, especially Olympia Dukakis in the role of Anna Madrigal. She's just, it's one of her all-time great roles.
Yeah. She and says that.
Yes, yes.
It's her favorite role. Yeah. She says it.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Perfect. Perfect casting for all of the characters. I wanted to know if there are any plans of continuing the miniseries. You know, because I know a lot of the actors have said, like Laura Linney would love to do it. And
have you done the math on this? Because Laura has.
Yeah.
Well, she's
you know, they're supposed to be
in their 60s, and she's just turned
50.
Well,
if we were to leap ahead, you know, to the when Olympia read this book, I sent it to her early. Of course, it's dedicated to her. And to my husband, Chris. And I sent it to her early, and she called me weeping, which is, she does a lot. She cusses and she weeps. She's Greek, and it's her right.
Yes.
And she said, how old is she again? And I said, 92. And she said, I can play that. But... Yeah, it would be very difficult to like pick up at Baby Cakes and go on. You know?
Well, maybe you could pick up at Michael Tolliver Lives and just do the last three.
Yeah, I just, you know, there's all sorts of. Thank you for wanting that to happen,
yes.
By the way.
Any producers in the room are welcome to talk to Armistead outside.
It's not for me to, you know, decide.
You're open to it, right?
I'm totally open to anything happen, any continuing life for this.
Mm-hmm. But the point is well taken. Sometimes a film becomes a kind of tribute to a work, and those films are very, very good.
We lucked out. You know? We really lucked out because that first miniseries in particular brought people to the story in a big way, and it brought these amazing friends into my life, like Olympia and Laura.
And Laura has just named her child. She's given her child your name.
Yeah, she gave birth 3 weeks ago to Bennett Armistead Shower.
There you go. Yeah.
She told me this when I was flat on my back in a dental chair in dental office, you know, getting my teeth cleaned.
That was my morning today. Yeah, this morning.
The dentist office?
Yeah, this has been much more fun than
that. Well, good. I made out such a yelp when I heard it because I knew she was pregnant, but I didn't know that. About this,
well,
and she waited
to
tell me until the baby
that's
was born.
That's so sweet.
Yeah.
And so Laura Linney.
So Laura.
She's so sweet.
She will do whatever it takes to give you the best possible thrill out of anything. She'll do it. I remember how she teased me back in 2000 when she said, "What are you doing on such and such a date?" And I said, "I don't know." She said, "Are you going to be watching the Oscars?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm a gay man." Yeah. And she said, "You want to watch it from the front row?" And I was her date.
Yeah.
I was her date for the Oscars.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a ball.
Yeah.
But I didn't think she could surprise me more than that. And by God, she did.
Yes.
Little Bennett.
But, you know, and that I think, shows the kind of love that circulates around your work and the sort of stories that you tell and the people who come into your life. And that's why we're all here tonight, I think. I want to thank all of you for coming out tonight. I want to thank Armistead for this wonderful new book and for being just you. You're fabulous.
Thank you.
Please support Aloud. Please support the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives. Go on our website. Make some donations. We appreciate your support. Come down for a tour. And Armistead will be outside in just a couple of minutes to sign your books and to say hello. So thank you, everybody, very much.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming. Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.